It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, more and more athletes are doing what seems impossible. When Joe Reddington pioneered the Iditarod sled dog race in the 1970s, driving dogs from Anchorage to Nome seemed extreme. Well, now we have people who run or bike over that trail, or further. There seems to be no limit. And today I have two incredible endurance athletes with me. Jennifer Farr Davis hiked the Appalachian Trail in 46 days, averaging 47 miles a day. David Johnston finished the 350-mile Iditarod Invitational in 4 days, running on snow. And on today's show, I'm hoping to learn what special quality makes that kind of achievement possible. And I want to learn with you how I can get a little bit of that myself. Not that I think that I'm going to be able to run 360 miles from Anchorage to Fairbanks, as Dave Johnston is planning to do just, what, next week?
Starting Monday.
You're going to start Monday. And how long do you think it'll take you to get to Fairbanks?
Hopefully four days, 90 miles a day. I'm going to go from UAA to UAF.
Okay, 90 miles a day. Yeah, easy. All right. But that's pretty close to what you averaged on the Iditarod Invitational.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So, Jennifer, you hold the record for hiking the Appalachian Trail, which for those of us in Alaska that don't know it, goes from where to where?
It goes from Georgia to Maine through 14 states, and it's about 2,185 miles.
Amazing. And now you're here in Alaska. You're touring different communities, speaking at libraries, and I guess you're speaking at the Homer Library tonight and then in Anchorage this weekend?
That's right. Uh-huh.
And tell me about your book, Called Again. What's that about?
Called Again is the story of our overall record on the Appalachian Trail, and I say ours because my husband helped me the entire time. We had a lot of people contribute to that effort, and I think the thing that really bothered me is there were so many misconceptions about going fast outdoors, especially for a long time. People said, oh, you can't enjoy it, or you don't appreciate nature, and I don't think people really understood what went into it or even what brought me to want to do something like that, so I felt like the best way to share that story was through a book, and that's what brought about Called Again.
Yeah, and I think that maybe some of our listeners don't need an education on why it's fun to go fast outdoors, but you know what, it sounds like you were a triathlete, you were doing a lot of different sports, and then you got into this long-distance fast hiking, and what made you want to do it?
You know, when I got into hiking, it wasn't fast at all. I did the Appalachian Trail as a 21-year-old on my own, and it was just a transformational journey. I came off with so much more self-confidence. I was more open-minded, more sure of who I was, and my whole sense of beauty had been just redefined. So it was a love of nature and wanting to give 100% to the trail that had given me so much that really brought me back to that place where I could say, what is 100%? If I pour all my energy out on the trail, what does that look like? And I think that's the question I wanted to answer going for the record.
So did you probably, I'm sure you had to train, but I don't know how you train for a 2,000-mile event.
Yeah, it's really difficult, especially with a family and a job. So I did as much as I could. It's funny because getting help, I could wear a very light pack or no pack on the trail, but I trained with this super heavy pack just to maximize, you know, the stress on my muscles and the time I had going up and down mountains. And I trained for about a year specifically just for the record. So as much as I could, I was moving.
So you were covering 47 miles a day, but a lot of that is pretty steep. It's not like if you're doing 47 miles on the level. How did you know how fast you're going to be able to do it? Did you have some days going up and down where you're going far fewer miles than other days when you're doing more?
Sure. Yeah, I think experience was really key. I didn't try for the overall record until my third actual completion of the Appalachian Trail. So I knew the terrain fairly well, and I actually laugh about it up here in Alaska. I don't like telling people how tall the mountains are on the AT because I feel like they kind of scoff at it. They're much, much lower.
We call them hills.
yeah, exactly. But it's very technical. I think that's what surprises people. A lot of stretches are so steep that you're not hiking with your feet. You're literally scrambling up mountains, pulling yourself up, sliding down. So on that terrain, I tried not to force it, just flow with it. And whatever I could do, that's what I could do. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
where are those really steep parts? Is that like up in Maine or?
Maine and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maine and New Hampshire are a different animal than the rest of the trail. And so some of my longest days, I would only do 30, 35 miles a day, but I was still putting in 16 or 17 hours on the trail.
Okay. And then other days you'd just put the hammer down and go as fast as you could. Would you actually jog or just really hike?
I really just hiked. And it's funny because the whole thought was, you know, this record had been set by trail runners and people going very quickly. And I knew from the beginning I wanted to hike as much as possible. And I thought I might have to run to raise my daily average as the trail became less difficult in the Southeast. But halfway through, I realized that I could hike 60 miles a day, and I felt better than if I tried to run. So I kept walking.
Wow. So 60 miles a day. So you're doing like 15-minute miles? I mean, you're sort of like almost jogging? Or how fast do you go?
On the AT, it was about 3 miles per hour. So, mm-hmm. you know, the average was 47 miles a day. And if I'm doing 16 hours at 3 miles per hour, that's around 48. So, again, that sort of includes the breaks during the day. But 16 or 17 hours a day was usually how long I was on my feet.
Wow. So David Johnston, you're our Alaskan version here. I'm not going to put you guys in competition because you both have done incredible stuff that's very different. And the Iditarod Invitational, you're actually running on snow. And I know you've had some amazing times, but this year, the four days kind of blew everybody's mind that you were able to do that. I mean, that was a record, right?
It was, yeah. And so just like Jennifer, I spent the last year, all I did was think about that record. And it was the opposite of what Jennifer had said. Nobody had ever run the ITI before, and I had done it the first year with my wife, and we had watched how people did it, and you know, people walked every step of the way. So the next year I entered it, I was up there with an elite guy, Joe Grant, and told him I'm gonna run the rest of the way, and he's like, you can't run that far, you know. And I love it when somebody tells me I can't do something.
Uh-huh.
And I was 4 hours from the record that year, and since then, so the next year, I just specifically trained for that record and, you know, ran every step of the way, had the gas pedal down the whole way, and just, you know, gave it all I had.
And you broke that record significantly.
13 hours, yeah, so it
wow.
was pretty neat. And then my body was broken after that for a little bit, so I had to go to a good physical therapist.
Wow. But, I mean, so we're talking about Willow to McGrath, and what is it, right?
It's Kinnick to McGrath.
Kinnick to McGrath. And what's the trail like? I mean, you'd have to be, to make that kind of time, it must be hard packed, right?
This year it was pretty good trail conditions. You know, mm-hmm. only ran into certain sections of maybe 20 miles at a time that was, you know, fluffy, real hard to run in snow. But, so this year was optimal for it. The year my wife and I did it together, we snowshoed at 3 miles an hour the whole way.
Oh, wow.
It was just deep.
Yeah. So if you're doing like 87, 90 miles a day, you're doing more than 3 marathons in a day, and then you're doing that for 4 days in a row. Why doesn't your body just fall apart? I mean, most people, like, they do a marathon, they're done for, you know, they say, well, you need to recover for, you know, 1 day per mile, so a month of recovery. But you actually, instead of recovering, you do it 2 more times in the same day.
Oh, yeah, it falls apart. And you have to just, you have to think about it and just, you know, your knee goes out. Well, I've got 2 knees. You got to try to do positive thinking. I know there was a spot in there when I was probably 280 miles into it, and every single piece of my body hurt. I would just touch, like, on my butt cheek, and it would scream, you know, anywhere
oh
I
God.
Touched. Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking you're going to say, well, you know, I'm just made out of different stuff than other people, so I could just do this and you can't. But actually, you're just a hell of a lot tougher. At least that's one big part of it. It's just being prepared to put yourself through some just torture.
You have to be if you want to go after the records, yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Jennifer? I mean, were you, when you're doing these, I mean, if I think about doing, you know, 16, 17-hour days, day after day for a month and a half, I know you'd be in amazing shape afterwards, but it seems like you would also be just horribly sore and tired.
Oh, yeah. I remember after the record, someone actually criticized me right afterwards because I wasn't doing these radio interviews and I wasn't taking phone calls. And they said, you need to maximize this time. And I said, I should be in the hospital. Like, I feel like a zombie right now. All I did for 48 hours after the record was just sleep. I mean, just sleep. And then I sort of, you know, and I think maybe Dave would attest to this too. It's not just physically exhausting. It's just so mentally taxing. You have to stay completely focused on that goal for so long that when you're done, you're done. And I think just like people, you know, focus on their training, you kind of have to focus on recovery to make sure that you heal properly.
Yeah. Tell us about your recovery, David. It sounds like it was pretty tough.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, after each time I've done the ITI, if, you know, right when you stop, you start swelling up. So usually 48 hours after you're done, you look double, your legs are double the size. And, you know, I go back to work at Geneva Woods Pharmacy, and my workmates there say, do you know who you are? You know, you're fuzzy and,
oh, wow,
and all of that. So it takes, I mean, even physically, you know, it probably takes 4 months before you can go for a normal run again. And
really?
Feel, you know, I start running as soon as I can, you know, hopefully a week later, just to try to flush the stuff out of the muscles, but you just can't even hit near where you were in shape for at least 4 months later. So it's really, it's amazing what it takes out of you.
Do you feel like that is maybe not that great for you long term, or have you thought about that?
You know, I think about it, and I think what it is I just don't have enough practice at it, so I'm going to try to do it more often.
Well, next week you're doing 360 miles, UAA to UAF, and that should that'll be pretty good.
Well, eventually, I'd like to start taking on some more Jennifer-like distances, but I'll wait till I get a little older and mature for those.
Huh. Wow. So, I mean, what's the, I was avoiding this question, but I can't help it. Why? You know what? You know, it's, there's so many things you could be doing and to do something that is so hard. Obviously most people would never even try. What's the main driver for you, David? And then I'll ask the same question of Jennifer.
You know, I think, a lot of it is, you know, the number one thing is people telling you can't do something, you know, and you can't do that, or it's impossible. So it's, you know, in your mind, if you know it's possible, you know, I think you can do it. The next thing is it's there. You know, how many times have you driven from Anchorage to Fairbanks? You know, the road, it's there. You might as well do it. The next thing is you can just eat whatever you want. You know,
yeah, that's right. I can tell you that David does not have a lot of extra pounds on him. Yeah.
And I just love the fact of you motivate other people. And that's the biggest thing. I love it when people start running because, you know, they've run with me, or, you know, just, you know, start out walking, and just the motivation factor. Mm-hmm. It's just a heck of a lot of fun. I've been running since I was 8 years old. And, you know, yesterday I was thinking about it. I was like mile 11 into my 14 mile run and just smiling ear to ear. And it was just great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. And you know what? You do see the world a little bit differently on foot. You know, I biked to Homer last summer from Anchorage, and it's nothing compared to what you're doing, obviously. But you do, I've driven that road a million times, but then when you bike it, you see it completely different. You guys have this different perception of the world around you when you're actually using your muscles to get through it.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Jennifer, answer the why question.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of things in life people say, for example, community service or relationships or whatever it might be, people say the more you give, the harder you work at it, the more you're going to get back. And I feel like, you know, nature, being in the wilderness, athletics, it's sort of the same thing. The more you give to it, the more you commit to it, the more time you spend doing it, the more you get back. And I think David and I both, people, they get the end story, and a lot of times they don't know what led into it. And I didn't wake up one morning without any experience saying, I want to set this record. I mean, I had been an athlete since I was very young. I had done the trail twice before. I had hiked all over the world. And this, for me, was a new way to experience it and a new way to challenge myself. And I think in life, you always want to seek out new challenges and new adventures. And I also, as a woman, you know, I feel like I'm in a bit of a different category because I knew that I really, really wanted to be a mom. And once I had children, the type of endurance events that I like to do would be very limited. I didn't feel like I could go out for months at a time or do, you know, thousands of miles on the trail. So before starting my family, I wanted the opportunity to feel free and light and unburdened and graceful. And, you know, again, answer that question, what is my best? So that when I had kids, I didn't have to look back and wonder what might have been.
And it sounds like you've used your your record and publicity and all that to write a book, and you're speaking about the book, and you have a business. And does that play into it at all, or is that just sort of a side benefit?
You know, when I found the trails, I was 21, and I got hooked right away. I started a hiking company in my mid-20s, and the whole goal was to get people outdoors through writing and speaking and also guiding on the trail. We have a guiding service in North Carolina. So all of this, I feel like the talks, the books, the record, it's just an extension of my love for the outdoors and wanting to get other people outside. And, you know, nature has a lot of lessons. And one that it's teaching me currently is that seasons are okay. Seasons are a natural part of life. And speaking of family, you know, I have an almost 2-year-old daughter. So now our hiking looks very different. It's like not so much hiking as picking up every rock and stick and looking at every berry and leaf along the way. But
unless you put her in a backpack, then you're just a little bit extra challenge.
Yeah, well, we did that for a while, and it was great exercise, and now she won't get in the backpack. So that's an issue we're dealing with. But I think, you know, I love this new season. Like, it's so special, and I don't think it's any better or any worse than the record. It's just, you know, that's the whole thing, is life is about these opportunities and challenges and adventures, and being able to embrace them and make the most of them is really important.
Yeah, great. Well, I think that's a good introductory section for us. And when we come back, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more technically about how you eat for this kind of an energy expenditure. I mean, it seems like there's no way you could eat enough to spend that much energy in that number of days, and how you train and how you get ready. We're talking about ultra endurance today, and my guests are Jennifer Farr Davis, who is touring Alaska right now. She's from Asheville, North Carolina. She has a book called Called Again, and she's going to be speaking at the Anchorage Library on Saturday. She's speaking at the Homer Library tonight. She's coming to us from Homer at KBBI. And in the studio with me is David Johnston, who is one of our very own, who set a new record in the Iditarod Invitational last winter and is getting ready to run from Anchorage to Fairbanks next week, a guy who covers an unbelievable number of miles. So we're going to be back in a little while. But right now we're going to take a quick break and hear from one of the Juno Ultra runners who soloed the 109-mile Klondike Relay over the weekend. Here's our producer, Monica Goki.
Over the weekend, some 170-odd teams participated in the Klondike Road Relay. Usually teams of 4 to 10 runners complete the long haul on foot from Skagway to Whitehorse through hilly terrain and breathtaking scenery. But this year, two Juno Ultra runners signed up to solo it. It was a first in the race's 32-year history. Claus Stolpe, 54, and Houston Laws, 29, both of Juno, finished the whole shebang. It took them 23 hours and 34 minutes. Both runners logged an average speed of 4.6 miles per hour. In Juno, KTOO's Matt Miller caught up with runner Houston Laws the Monday after the race.
Sounds like you both ran together during the entire race, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we ran side by side the whole way.
And so you kind of used each other to kind of pull yourself along, I guess?
Yeah, definitely. We used each other to our advantage and kept each other company, talked about everything for that 23, hours.
Any sort of particular training or that you underwent before this particular race to prepare for something that is, you know, 4 times longer than the usual marathon?
I like to run on tired legs and not really allow full rest. And so I run back-to-back days with with long days or hill days and long days together, but just continuously running on tired legs and fatigued legs without injuring yourself, I think it became an advantage, and that's what I've definitely experienced.
What is it that you do to kind of maintain your concentration or your focus or your enthusiasm?
Keep your enthusiasm. It's a lot of times just the scenery, being out there in the isolation, and really appreciating nature, being out on the trail, and a lot of inspiration.
Laws finished up by telling KTOO that he did indeed have plans to lace up for another solo run during next year's Klondike Relay. For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Gokey.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is ultra endurance. And I've got two remarkable athletes with me today. Jennifer Farr Davis is coming to us from KBBI in Homer. Jennifer is from Asheville, North Carolina, and she did the entire Appalachian Trail, 2,000 miles plus, in a record 46 days. And in the studio, Alaska's own David Johnston. Who has done some remarkable records of his own, including the 350-mile Iditarod Invitational, which he did in 4 days last year. And I wanted to talk a bit about the energy consumption of doing this kind of mileage. It seems to me, having done some long ski races, that it's really hard to get enough calories into your body to stay with that energy expenditure, and in fact, you really are kind of at a deficit at the end of a, 3-hour ski race, and you are going to be hungry the next couple of days and feel low on energy until you kind of restore your muscles. But if you're just going day after day after day, how do you just even get enough calories on board? Let's start with you, Jennifer. When you're on the Appalachian Trail and you're covering this kind of mileage, and you're only taking 6 or 7 hours off a day, how do you manage your nutrition?
Well, I think constantly eating is very important. You don't want real lows and spikes of sugar coming in. So I was putting food in my mouth every hour and a half on the trail. And then a few times a day I would have a meal of about 1,500 calories that, again, I would even try to eat that very quickly, usually stationary, but I try to eat about 1,500 calories in 15 minutes. So I was going for over 6,000 calories a day and still losing weight on the trail. I think it was probably impossible to keep up with the amount of energy that I actually needed each day. And, to add to that, the whole second half of the hike, so we're talking 3 weeks, I was nauseous. I was horribly nauseous, and it was hard to take food in. So no matter what your nutrition plan is, at some point it's just whatever you can get down. I think I started with, more high-nutrient foods, and towards the end I was begging my husband to bring me milkshakes and french fries whenever he could. And
liquid you're just,
calories
like, desperately hungry at that point, right?
Yeah, anything I didn't have to chew. I mean, I was doing Ensures. I really honestly have not had an energy bar since that summer. I cannot smell an energy bar anymore. it's not really food. It's just fuel. So whatever you can get down, as much as you can get down. And then for me, before and after, I really focus on healthy, high-quality food, but on the trail, just whatever I can get in, I want to get in.
So what caused the nausea that you had in the last 3 weeks of your hike?
Well, it wasn't pregnancy. I actually took a pregnancy test on the trail because I was like, I've never been this nauseous ever. I don't know what this could be. It's not going away. But I think it was just hiking 46 miles a day that did it.
Mm-hmm. Your body was just saying, no, stop.
Yeah, my body, I mean, your body tries to shut down. And that's, I think, where it gets really interesting. And you have the whole mind-body dynamic of your body saying, this isn't good. I'm going to self-preserve. I'm going to try to stop this. And your mind has to push through that. And at the same time, listen to your body and try to give it some of what it needs.
Right. So how do you get on board that number of calories? I mean, I've heard of some people like eating sticks of butter and stuff to just, you know, winter endurance athletes just trying to cram calories into their body. Do you have any tricks or do you just eat huge meals?
I really think my trick was liquid calories and not, I didn't touch alcohol that summer. I mean, it just wouldn't have helped anything, but the liquid calories of Ensures, fruit smoothies, milkshakes, it went in so quickly and absorbed quickly and I didn't have to chew. And so for me, that was one thing that really helped.
What about you, David? How do you manage it on a 4-day, 350-mile run? What's your nutritional approach?
Well, it's funny when people always ask me this question. I'm the worst person to ask about nutrition on the run. I eat pretty healthy in normal everyday life, but out in the race, any races, I am not a good eater. Like Jennifer, I'll get nauseous and so I try to go as many miles as I can without food. I can, you know, I've over the last few years, I've experimented with it, and I can, you know, go about 100 miles with zero calories, and
God,
people can't believe
incredible.
That. But
what
know,
about, are you drinking like Gatorade or drinking something that's got some kind of...
You know, if I can get a cold Budweiser, I love that.
You're kidding.
But mainly sugary things.
So would you actually drink alcohol on one of these runs?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, we're talking about a real Alaskan here.
Yeah, but other than that, sugary things. Try to nibble on gummy bears and stuff like that. Solid food is really hard. You have to actually be stopped almost for me for solid food. Like Jennifer was saying, I can't eat beef jerky now ever again after a race a couple years ago. But
do you get sick too?
Usually for me, it's the first 24-hour period. And then once I get over it, I'm good to go. So getting over that 24-hour hump is the hard part. And then the days after that are great. You feel good. And actually, I run faster and stronger on minimal calories, but I think there's a limit to it. And so I haven't pushed it, you know, over weeks and stuff like that. But for, you know, a 3-4-5-day race, your body has enough fat in there, and then you actually start burning muscle, and it's weird, you smell different when you start burning muscle. It's, you can tell it's happening.
Wow.
I tell a joke after the ITI this year. I was like, I used to have a little bit of man boobs, but they ate each other.
People got to see you're really skinny.
I don't
have a lot of extra fat on you, and so it's for you to say, well, I can run for 4 or 5 days without eating, it just seems like you just disappear and go, poof.
Yeah. No, usually I try to have about 5 extra pounds on me before a big long distance event, and then I definitely burn it all. You know, I'll burn 6 pounds over 4 days, 7 pounds pretty easily.
Mm. So, what's your limit? I mean, in terms of how many days you're able to keep running, or do you know?
Yeah, I don't know that yet. So,
what's the longest you've gone? In terms of days?
As far as just running consistently, so far it's been about 5 days. Yeah.
So. And it sounds like when you finished the 100, the 350 in 4 days, you were feeling pretty fried. I mean, it wasn't like you
I probably had another day left in
me.
Yeah. I always, keep a little in the bank, you know.
Amazing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't come to the finish line and collapse or anything.
Uh-huh.
Definitely. So eventually one day I'd like to take on the event to Nome, which is 1,000 miles, and actually try to run it. You know, that one's another one that's never been run before. So
the cold also costs you a lot of calories, I would think. Do you think the cold affects your distance that you can cover or the speed that you can run?
It definitely does. You know, I can tell it just in training in the summer. Usually it's hard for me to lose the few extra baby fat pounds. And in the winter, it's hard for me to keep on weight. And that's just from training in the cold. It increases your metabolism. And so it's definitely a lot different. Yeah.
How cold will you go down to before you say, I'm going inside?
Well, no, I train outside every single day.
Yep. Okay, so 10 below, 20 below, you don't care?
Oh, yeah, and we live in Willow where 30 below is very common. And, you know, it's not the most fun runs, but if you're going to be out there racing and that stuff, I think that's why I have a huge advantage is I go out there and train every single day on exactly what I'm going to be racing in.
Uh-huh. What do you do? I mean, people say, well, don't exert yourself. You know, even the elite skiers will say like 5 degrees or zero. Do you do anything to protect your lungs, or do you think that's just a wives' tale?
I think it's a wives' tale. I think, you know, I think if you start frostbiting stuff, it's not. But as far as breathing in the air, you know, the only thing I've noticed at like 30 below and stuff, you will produce like a little cough. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I take a dust mask and then cut about a quarter size hole in it and just wear it. So then it's kind of almost like a rebreather.
Right.
But you're getting a little fresh air in there, and it keeps the air around your mouth moist and warmer.
It's like a Willow style rebreather, as opposed to these Olympic athletes who have these expensive ones, right?
Where I live, it's all dog mushers, and actually I've had dog teams just freak out and get all tangled because they see this you know, guy in a dust mask. I look like the killer out there.
Because so. I think you do free some of those cilia from your throat, and I think that's where the cough comes from, is if you're super cold and you don't have anything. Yeah. It sounds like you're like made by a different maker, though, than the rest of us.
No, I mean, no.
Jennifer, it doesn't sound like you'd be into running at 30 below, just from what you're saying.
No, don't ask me about the cold. I do think it's interesting because before we went live, David said he was from North Carolina originally. So I think it's really interesting. It's really cool how well he's acclimated to these conditions, because I know it's really hard for me to be super cold. Like even, you know, we were camping in Denali and it was 20 degrees at night and I felt like it was affecting my lungs and my chest. But on the other hand, I'm perfectly comfortable in 100 degree heat. So
well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. When I go running, when I'm in the lower 48, I mean, I'll be like 75 degrees and I'll just be falling apart. And people will say, well, what's the matter with you? But you, on your Appalachian Trail hike and a lot of stuff you do, you must have to deal with heat.
Oh, yeah. The heat and humidity on the AT in the summer are killer. And, you know, it's interesting. For example, you know, someone who went after the record this summer started later, I think, to limit that heat. But when you start later, you also limit the hours of daylight you have. So I really wanted to maximize daylight, which meant I had 100 degree days, I had high humidity. But coming from the South, again, I played tennis in college in Alabama. So it was like so hot. And then we were out there all the time. And I even remember on the Pacific Crest Trail out west, which was the second really long trail that I hiked, I really felt good about myself in the desert because I was passing all these experienced hikers just being like, yeah, this is awesome. And then we got to the snowfields of the High Sierra, and every single one of them walked right by me. So, yeah, I think I'm on the other extreme. But if I lived in a place as beautiful as Alaska, I would certainly want to get out as much as possible as well.
You'd probably get used to it after a couple of years. I think the body adjusts a little bit. But what do you do to, hydration must be a really major issue when you are covering that many miles in that kind of heat. And if you're trying to go fast, you can only carry so much water, I would think. How did you handle that?
Sure. Well, two things. Number one, almost anyone who came to pace me or hike with me always remarked, we can't believe you're not drinking more water. So I do think my body acclimated even to that. I mean, I was drinking throughout the day, but not nearly as much as you would expect in those conditions. And then the other saving grace is that the AT is a very water-friendly trail. There's tons of sources along the way. And having done the trail twice before, I kind of knew where the sources were, knew if they were good or bad, you know, whether they were in a field with cows or a high mountain spring. And so I planned to use all the sources I could on trail and not have to carry much water from the road crossings. So I always picked up what I could from the forest.
Yeah, and let's also talk about pacing, because it sounds like for both of you guys have set records where a pretty competitive situation, but I mean, the AT has been hiked, you know, for so many years, and so tons of competition. And you talked about hitting it when you have more daylight. It seems like figuring out the pacing would be critical so that you know you can keep it up over the long term, but also that it's going to be fast enough to do it. Was there some strategy or some calculation in that, or how did you figure out like how fast you wanted to go?
Well, when I say pacing, I guess I use that term loosely, because we did have a lot of folks come help us, but the biggest asset was emotional support. I almost always walked in front if someone was with me. We could do what you call muling, where they would carry food or gear, and that often was extremely helpful. But more than anything, over a 46-day period, I want relationships. I want communication, and I need that to keep going. And so, you know, it was really cool in this sad way, because my husband tore his ACL right before we started, and he had planned to be my support and hike with me as much as he could. And when he couldn't, we started calling friends, families, hikers, trail runners along the trail. And no one ever hiked with me for a full day, but every now and then folks would come out and spend several hours, several miles with me on the path. And, you know, one thing I always asked when someone came out was, tell me your worst relationship story, because it would always last forever, and it would always take my mind off, you know, how bad we were feeling in the mountain we were climbing, and it would, you know, usually make me laugh, make me cry, and take my mind off the task at hand. So I get to know people really well and really appreciated all the support we received.
That's a great psychological trick is think of something really bad, right? Then sort of things so that what you're doing doesn't seem so bad.
Exactly.
So David, tell me about your pacing, because it seems like it's critical. If you're sort of really running fast, you would never be able to go 4 days. On the other hand, if you go too slow, then you're going to leave something out there. How do you find that? Is that sort of the key to setting records on some of these long distance things for you?
Yeah, and then I'll let Jennifer answer the question again. Uh-huh. I think you meant pacing miles per hour pacing, Jennifer.
Pacing miles per hour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you figure out your pace, David?
Oh man, that's still learning how to figure it out. You know, just the last you know, when I. This winter, when I set the Susitna 100 record, and then the following week set the ITI record, I went right off the starting line.
So just so people understand that, you did a 100-mile race, set the record. 1 week later, you did a 350-mile race and set the record.
Yep. So it was...
I mean, it makes sense. Like,
yeah, I was pretty banged up in the week
in
between.
You sure you don't have a twin?
Well, actually, I do. The real David Johnston, he's sitting back in Talkeetna right now. Probably scheming his next winter ascent of McKinley, but
well, he's pretty impressed with you too,
and he had great things to say about you. But both of those two record attempts, right from the start, I just put the pedal down as far, you know, I went as fast as I could run in snow, and just was like, I'm going to hang on for dear life. And
wow! So you would have, if you'd been doing a marathon or half marathon, you would have been at the same pace.
Oh, probably a little, you know, definitely faster than a 350-mile mm-hmm. race, but, you know, it's not very much slower. Or, you know, like the 350-mile race, I went out as fast as I did at the 100.
Wow.
You know, and you just hang on for dear life. And
did you go slower and slower through the course of the race?
Actually, I sped up, which
really?
Was neat. Yeah, which baffled a lot of people. And I think, you know, I think there's different factors that I found out. You know, like I said, that 5-pound weight cushion. Mm-hmm. Once I lose that 5 pound or 6 or 7 pounds of weight, it's so much easier to run up the hills and stuff like that. So there's certain, you know.
You're blowing my mind again.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of uncharted waters in this sport, and you know what we have here, you know, between Jennifer and myself, are just the start of things to come. You know, I really do.
Well, I think that's another good place to take a break. I'm talking with David Johnston, who has done these amazing, amazing ultramarathon distances here in Alaska, and Jennifer Farr Davis, who is from North Carolina but is visiting Alaska right now. She's coming to us from KBBI in Homer. She's the author of Called Again, and will be speaking Saturday at the library here in Anchorage. She's speaking tonight in Homer. And when we come back, I want to ask them both about training and about suffering, and if there's anything they can help the rest of us understand to be able to do those things better, because that seems to be a big part of their accomplishments, besides just being born from a different species as the rest of us. But first, we're going to take a break. Last month, one of my guests, David, participated in a six-day ultra running event. That was 6 days, all indoors. Not a lot of people's idea of a good time. Our producer, Monica Goki, popped by halfway through the race to see how the athletes were faring.
It was almost 11 at night on a Wednesday in the Alaska Dome in early August, and Willow, Alaska resident Dave Johnston had been running for nearly 3 days. Some of that time was spent hunched over the toilet, puking. Multi-day ultra running is extremely hard on athletes.
Stomach's finally starting to feel better, and so now let's just see if we can run.
You're getting in a groove. Now, you've done a lot outdoors. What made you sign up for a six-day event?
Joe, pretty much.
Johnston's talking about Joe Feegis. He's the one who came up with his event.
Sent an email and stuff. I told him yesterday when I was running in the bathroom puking all day, I told him, thanks so much. And he said he was sorry because he knew how bad I felt. That was funny.
But you straightened up a bit?
So far right now, yeah. The last 12 hours has been the first time I've felt good the whole race, so.
Johnston recovered from his rough start. By Friday, Johnston was in second place, trailing the leader by less than 20 miles.
Whew, he's fast.
And the competition was stiff. The six-day ultra event was called 6 Days in the Dome, and it's just like it sounds. Runners logged as many miles as they could in 6 days. It sounds crazy, and it kind of is.
This is what we chosen to do with our vacation time and with our extra dollars.
That was Ed Ettinghausen of Southern California. He's dressed like a jester, and he brought 6 different jester outfits to the race, one for each day. His wife and daughter are sleeping at one end of the track while he puts one foot in front of the other, smiling, bells bouncing atop his jester hat. There's another guy here from Brazil who ran 142 miles on the first day of the race. You can tell that people were equally impressed slash appalled by his feat. But by Wednesday night, he was out of the race, sleeping on a high jump mat to recover. One of the race organizers, Zane Holscher of North Carolina, says this motley crew of nearly 50 is actually one of the most elite packs of ultra runners worldwide.
To do this on this track, day after day, and when you sleep, you get so tight, and then they had to come out and run again. I can't tell you the level of people we have here, just mental toughness, physical toughness, it's unbelievable.
So how did they end up in Alaska?
Turns out there's only a couple facilities like this in all North America with a 400-meter track indoors. Most of them are 200-meter or 300-meter tracks.
Race organizers wanted an indoor, temperature-controlled, element-free track that would allow the runners to simply run.
And this turned out perfect because everyone in Alaska wants to be outside in the summer instead of inside, and we want to be inside. So kind of a supply and demand, we were able to work out something great with the Dome, and I cannot say enough about how great this facility is.
The Dome also doubled as a hotel for the race. At one end of the track, runners set up camp. Sweaty clothes were draped over hurdles to dry, and athletes were curled up on high jump mattresses that doubled as beds. And the event was even serving its own food, 3 meals a day.
Eggs, bacon, Pop-Tarts, pancakes, Pop-Tarts, breakfast burritos, Pop-Tarts, oatmeal, Pop-Tarts, eggs, bacon, Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts are the standard fare here.
Everything is runner food. After a couple of days, if it can't get away or kill you, it's food.
And we have a sushi lunch on Thursday.
After 6 sleepless days and nights, the race finished on Sunday morning. Race organizer Joe Feegis of Atlanta, Georgia, took first, having logged 580 miles. For the women, Liz Bauer logged 425 miles for the win, and 6th place overall. No runners broke the 600-mile goal the cash prize was contingent on. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki. Running, running.
We're back. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is endurance, super endurance, endurance beyond what you would think possible. And our guests are Alaska ultra runner Dave Johnston, who was just featured on the report from that 6 day indoor event, and visiting endurance athlete Jennifer Farr Davis, who is the author of Called Again, and she'll be speaking this Saturday at the Anchorage Library to talk about her record-setting completion of the Appalachian Trail in 46 days. Well, I wanted to get into training and how you guys get ready for an event like this, and how you build up the kind of muscle and energy in your body that you need in order to hold it together for these distances. I'm quite sure that I'll never be able to do that, and the vast majority of listeners will never be able to do what you guys can do, but we'd all like to be better. Let's see if we can sort of get some tips from what your experience is about for the rest of us who want to be endurance athletes at our own level. Jennifer, what's your training regime like when you're getting ready for a record-setting attempt?
You know, I honestly think the physical training is probably the easiest part of it, and the one that people focus on the most, and what's overlooked a lot of times, is the mental and emotional training. Especially for, you know, what I do on the really long trails, the 2,000-mile-plus trails, a big part of it's learning how to be uncomfortable, not just physically sore and tired from the exertion, but, you know, when I was out there 46 days, I maybe got a motel room 6 nights, and all the other nights I was in my sleeping bag, I was dirty, I was doing, you know, 350 miles without a shower. Again, it was hot and humid, and this is the East Coast, so there's a different, more pungent smell.
It's stinky,
along
yeah.
with that. So, you know, I think doing a lot of visualization, having experience doing the multi-day treks, a lot of people coming to the effort having completed, like, 100-mile races, which are intense and hard and so challenging, but last a day, and then you get a shower and you get warm food, and they were used to those creature comforts. I really, you know, sometimes I would train by not taking showers, or sometimes, which was no fun for my husband. But, you know, I really tried to prepare myself for not just the physicality of it, but also the emotional and mental hardships that go along with it.
Is there also an aspect, though, that you need to do a lot of long runs or a lot of long hikes, multi-hour, that the body develops a certain endurance capability, or do you think that's overrated?
You know, I think different people would have different theories on that. It's very difficult, as you mentioned earlier, to train for something that you're going to do for 7 weeks for 16 or 17 hours a day. You're not really going to have the time to train how you should. So for me, I focus on consistent movement rather than doing a long run, like rather than waiting till the weekend and going for a 60-mile run. I would try throughout the day, if I had an hour before breakfast, an hour during lunch, you know, 2 or 3 hours after work, I tried to move as consistently throughout the day and throughout the week as possible, instead of doing it in chunks, because I knew when I got out on the trail, it would just be consistent movement.
I want to hear what David thinks of that. What's your do you have a similar strategy, or what's your strategy?
It's you know, it's funny. We're exact opposites. I do mine in one time, and then the rest of the day I rest or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But
what's your sort of getting ready for the 100-mile or the 350-mile race? What kind of training regime or schedule do you keep?
Yeah, basically, I try to put in the equivalent of 100 miles a week, which is, in the winter for the ITI, I pull a sled with about 30 pounds of dumbbells in it to mimic pulling your survival gear that you have to pull behind you over the snow. And it's really hard to put in 100 miles a week pulling a sled behind you. So 80 miles a week, you know, was the goal for that. And I did that 3 months prior to the race, you know, every single day.
So you just said something that I just was really not tracking, and I should have, is that you did the 350 miles in 4 days while pulling a sled.
Yeah, you have to pull a sled you won't have your food with you, and you won't have your puffy coat and your, mm-hmm. you know, your snowshoes and stuff like that.
Yeah, so we haven't really gotten into how the race works, but you're not stopping at checkpoints at night. You're camping out primarily, right?
It depends. They're the actual Iditarod dog sled checkpoints. So if you can make it to those checkpoints, you know, sometimes they're, the longest distance is 100 miles apart. So you'll have to, you have to plan on making it 100 miles if you don't stop somewhere. So, yeah.
How did you manage that? Did you spend more time camping or more time in a warm shelter?
Yeah, I found out in this sport I don't require much sleep, so I just keep moving. If I can get 2 hours of sleep every 24-hour period, I'm pretty good. So I could make it checkpoint to checkpoint, so I had a little bit easier. I have bivvied on the trail at, 10 below zero, and it's not the most fun thing to do.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And it takes some... there's some time and some mental effort that's necessary to set up a camp and be safe in the middle of the night in super cold weather. I mean, it's not like something you can just sort of, yeah?
No. I mean, you worry, you don't want to go to sleep because you worry when you wake up, you won't feel your toes.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just don't sleep. I keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you did a 100-mile race and then a week later you did a 350-mile race. So obviously you recover a lot faster than most people do.
I think so. And I think it's because I do active recovery. Like the very next day I get out there and I probably can't run because I'm hobbling, but I get out there and walk, I clean the bad stuff out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the trick to it. I know so many racers who do a great event and then they don't do anything for 3 weeks because they've done their event and they sit on the couch and then it takes them months to rebuild again. Mm-hmm. So I think active recovery is the best way.
Yeah. So Jennifer talked about the sort of the mental aspect of training and being prepared just for the amount of suffering you're going to have out there. Do you have any, like, what's your secret? Do you have anything to prepare for that part of it?
Well, first of all, I think you need a supportive family. You need a wife that loves you so much and kids that are willing to help you out. That's the best thing, is to try to live as stress-free as possible. Because if you're training 100 miles a week and then you have this, I have a great job. If you had the stress of a lousy job and then you had stress of home, you couldn't pull it off. So being stress-free is definitely the key, because then, like Jennifer said, you can just focus mentally on your training and it just all clicks. So
yeah. Jennifer, how do you, what's your secret, or how do you develop that mental toughness, which is almost, it's going way beyond what most sort of weekend runners would do. It's going into a zone where you're really forcing your body to do something your body is just screaming you cannot do, and that probably it would be smarter not to do, just if you're, in terms of your well-being. How do you get to that point where you can force yourself over that hump?
Yeah, well, I have to agree with David. It was funny, when I got married, I thought marriage was going to really slow me down, and it's my husband who's actually, in some ways taken a lot off my plate to allow me to focus on what it is I love, and without his support, I never could have accomplished something like the Appalachian Trail record. So having a team, I think having a supportive team helps you break through those mental barriers. And David mentioned this earlier, but staying positive. You gotta look for the silver lining, or at least tell yourself that, things aren't always going to get worse, because it gets pretty rough out there. And I think especially for these long distance events, I don't like to focus on the entire distance. I really do try to live in the moment and make short-term goals, because when you think of the picture overall, it just becomes extremely overwhelming. I think people would definitely feel differently about this aspect, but I try pretty hard not to focus on what other people have accomplished and just constantly tell myself to do my best, because I can get demoralized when I'm worried about what other people are doing. But when I just focus on what I'm doing, things seem to go pretty well. So those are some of my tricks, and I'll definitely be interested to hear what David has to add to that.
Well, one of the things I'm noticing is you guys are both like super positive, optimistic, outgoing individuals, and I think maybe that is part of the secret, because you might sort of stereotypically think of somebody who do an ultra marathon thing as being sort of like deadly serious and like some kind of crazy like tunnel vision person, but instead, no, you're sort of, sounds like you're just making it sound fun, which is amazing. And I found in my much lesser accomplishments is that like all it takes is one negative thought, right? You can be chugging along and you just have one negative thought and you're ready to quit. And so you've got to sort of maybe keep those negative thoughts out of your head. And some people might be better at that than others. I don't know. What do you think of that, Jennifer?
I definitely agree. I mean, being positive you know, no matter what you're doing, it doesn't matter if you're running long distances or not, it's really going to help. And, you know, you can't, I think ultra running is something, or hiking, that you can take off trail, and it makes your life better. I mean, you learn that you can't always control your external circumstances, but you can control your reaction or your response. And that message is very empowering no matter what you're doing.
Yeah. David, do you have some mental tricks that keep you going when you just really want to quit?
Oh, man. Yeah, you just, well, you know, I have quit races, and you live with that forever. So you try to think of that, you know, and sometimes you're forced to quit. But, you know, those times you don't, and you keep going, you end up winning. You're like, man, I was going to quit.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's luck. And, you know, like you were saying about the positive stuff is, you know, that's why, you know, Jennifer and myself are great advocates for the sport, is because of the positive attitudes. You know, half the people you meet out there, a lot of they're in it solely for themselves, and they don't spread the love and spread the word. And, you know, you were saying earlier, you would never be able to do that, but I think everybody can. If you get out there with the right training, you know, the human body is amazing, and it's wild what you can transform yourself into with just by doing it.
All right. So we're just about out of time. David, you are taking off for Fairbanks, 360-mile run. And are you doing it to promote your business, or is there a message to it? Or
yeah, actually, the company I work for, Geneva Woods Healthcare, our slogan is "There's no place like healthy." So they're kicking me out of the office to go promote health and fitness, which is great. They've been great supporters of mine for many, many years. I've been with them for over a decade, and they've supported me in the Boston marathons, and
yeah,
I did a Rod Trail invitationals and stuff. So what a great opportunity to go try to do it. I know it's been tried before, and I don't think it's been done. So,
well, if anyone can do it, I think you can.
Well, thanks, Charles.
Yeah. Jennifer, and you're speaking in Homer tonight in Anchorage at the library. Do you know what time your Saturday event is?
Yeah. Saturday is at the Lusac Library at 1 p.m.
And is that a free to the public event?
It's free, and it's, you know, very family friendly. We'd love for anyone to come out.
All right. And what do you have in about 30 seconds? What's your next thing? Are you good at planning another big accomplishment, or are you just riding in your laurels?
Well, we're in a different season. So our goal is to hike in all 50 states as a family, and Alaska is 48. So by the time our daughter turns 2 in November, we'll have hopefully done all 50.
That's great.
That sounds great. And another book, maybe?
We'll see.
All right.
Another book, another kid. Who knows?
Yeah, right. Well, in her Jennifer Farr Davis's book is called Called Again. You'll find a link to her website, her Blue Ridge Hiking Company, on alaskapublic.org. Many thanks to KBBI for hosting Jennifer today. And David Johnson was in the studio here with me in Anchorage. On our next Outdoor Explorer, join me to talk about geocaching. Slightly less taxing activity, lots of fun, great for families. It's sort of like a treasure hunt with a GPS, and it's getting really popular in Alaska. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.